Max used to take May to the skating rink was easy. The suits there were safety orange and green, made to be visible to rescuers. Camouflage would have been more appropriate. The masks smelled of volatile plastic, and the joints were just rings sewn into the material. The suit heaters looked ill-cared for and likely to catch on fire if used too long. Another blast came, followed by two others, each sounding closer than the one before. "Nukes," Naomi said. "Maybe Gauss rounds," Holden replied. They might have been talking about the weather. Prax shrugged. "Either way, a hit that gets into a corridor means superheated steam," he said, pressing the last seal along his side closed and checking the cheap green LED that promised the oxygen was flowing. The heating system flickered to yellow, then back to green. "You and Amos might make it if your armor's good. I don't think Naomi and I stand a chance." "Great," Holden said. "I've lost the Rossi," Naomi said. "No, I've lost the whole link. I was rooting through the somnambulist. She must have taken off." Or been slagged. The thought was on all their faces. No one said it. "Over this way," Prax said, "there's a service tunnel we used to use when I was in college. We can get around the Marble Arch complex and head up from there."
"Whatever you say, buddy," Amos said. His nose was bleeding again.
The blood looked black in the faint blue light inside his helmet. It was his last walk. Whatever happened, Prax was never coming back here. Because here wouldn't exist. The fast lope along the service corridor where Jamie Loomis and Tana Ibtramin-Suk had taken him to get high was the last time he'd see that place. The broad, low-ceilinged amphitheater under the old water treatment center where he'd had his first internship was cracked. The reservoir compromised. It wouldn't flood the corridors quickly, but in a couple of days the passageways would be filled in. In a couple of days, it wouldn't matter. Everything glowed in the emergency LEDs or else fell into shadow. There was slush on the ground as the heating system struggled to compensate for the madness and failed. Twice, the way was blocked. Once by a pressure door that was actually still functional. Once by an ice fall. They met almost no one. The others were all running for the port. Prax was leading them almost directly away from it now. Another long, curved hall, then up a construction ramp through an empty tunnel, and the blue steel door that blocked their way wasn't locked, but it was in safety mode. The indicator said there was vacuum on the other side. One of the godlike fists pummeling Ganymede had broken through here. Prax stopped, his mind clicking through the three-dimensional architecture of his home station. If the secret base was there, and he was here, then... "We can't get there," he said. The others were silent for a moment. "That's not a good answer," Holden said. "Find a different one." Prax took a long breath. If they doubled back, they could go down a level, head to the west and try getting to the corridor from below, except that a blast strong enough to break through here would almost certainly have compromised the level below, too. If they kept going to the old tube station, they might be able to find a service corridor. Not that he knew there was one, but maybe, and it might lead in the right direction. Three more detonations came, shaking the ice. With a sound like a baseball bat hitting a home run, the wall beside him cracked.
"Prax, buddy," Amos said. "Sooner it'd be better."
They had environment suits, so if they opened the door, the vacuum wouldn't kill them. But there would be debris choking it. Any strike hard enough to break through to the surface would... "We can't get there through the station tunnels," he said. "But we can go up, get to the surface and go that way." And how do we do that? Holden asked. Finding an access way that wasn't locked down took 20 minutes, but Prax found one. No wider than three men walking abreast, it was an automated service unit for the dome exteriors. The service unit itself had long since been cannibalized for parts, but that didn't matter. The airlock was still working under battery power. Naomi and Prax fed it the instructions, closed the inner door, and cycled the outer open. The escaping pressure was like a wind for a moment, and then nothing. Prax walked out onto the surface of Ganymede. He'd seen images of the aurora from Earth. He'd never imagined he'd see anything like it in the blackness of his own sky. But there, not just above him, but in lines from horizon to horizon, were streaks of green and blue and gold, chaff and debris, and the radiating gas of cooling plasma. Incandescent blooms marked torch drives. Several kilometers away, a Gauss round slammed into the moon's surface, the seismic shock knocking them from their feet. Prax lay there for a moment, watching the water ejecta geyser up into the darkness, and then begin to fall back down as snow. It was beautiful. The rational, scientific part of his mind tried to calculate how much energy transfer there was to the moon when a railgun-hurled chunk of tungsten hit it. It would be like a miniature nuke without all the messy radiation. He wondered if the round would stop before it hit Ganymede's nickel-iron core. Okay, Holden said over the cheap radio in Prax's emergency suit. The low end of the sound spectrum was lousy, and Holden sounded like a cartoon character. Which way now? I don't know, Prax said, rising to his knees. He pointed toward the horizon. Over there, somewhere. I need more than that, Holden said. I've never been on the surface before, Prax said. In a dome, sure, but just out? I mean, I know we're close to it, but I don't know how to get there. All right, Holden said. In the high vacuum over his head, something huge and very far away detonated. It was like the old cartoon light bulb of someone getting an idea. We can do this. We can solve this. Amos, you head toward that hill over there. See what you can see. Prax and Naomi, start going that direction. I don't think we need to do that, sir, Naomi said. Why not? Naomi raised her hand, pointing back behind Holden and Prax both. Because I'm pretty sure that's the Rossi setting down over there, she said. Chapter 22. Holden. The secret landing pad lay in the hollow of a small crater. When Holden crested the lip and saw the Rocinante below him, the sudden and dizzying release of tension told him how frightened he'd been for the last several hours. But the Rossi was home, and no matter how hard his rational mind argued that they were still in terrible danger, home was safe. As he paused a moment to catch his breath, the scene was lit with bright white light, like someone had taken a picture. Holden looked up in time to see a fading cloud of glowing gas in high orbit. People were still dying in space just over their heads. Wow, Prax said. It's bigger than I expected. Corvette, Amos replied, obvious pride in his voice. Frigate-class fleet escort ship. I don't know what any of that means, Prax said. It looks like a big chisel with an upside-down coffee cup on the back. Amos said, That's the drive. Enough, Holden cut in. Get to the airlock. Amos led the way, sliding down the crater's icy wall, hunched down on his heels and using his hands for balance. Prax went next, for once not needing any help. Naomi went third, her reflexes and balance honed by a lifetime spent in shifting gravities. She actually managed to look graceful. Holden went last, fully prepared to slip and go down the hill in a humiliating tumble, then pleasantly surprised when he didn't. As they bounded across the flat floor of the crater toward the ship, the outer airlock door slid open, revealing Alex in a suit of Martian body armor and carrying an assault rifle. As soon as they were close enough to the ship that they could cut through the orbital radio clutter, Holden said,
"Alex, man, is it good to see you."
"Hey, Cap,"
Alex replied, even his exaggerated drawl not able to hide the relief in his voice.
"Wasn't sure how hot this LZ would be. Anyone chasing you?"
Amos ran up the ramp and grabbed Alex in a bear hug that yanked him off his feet.
"Man, it's fucking good to be home," he said.
Prax and Naomi followed, Naomi patting Alex on the shoulder as she went by.
"You did good, thank you."
Holden stopped on the ramp to look up one last time. The sky was still filled with the flashes and light trails of ongoing battle. He had the sudden visceral memory of being a boy back in Montana, watching massive thunderheads flash with hidden lightning. Alex watched with him, then said,
"It was a bit hectic coming in."
Holden threw an arm around his shoulder.
"Thanks for the ride."
Once the airlock had finished cycling and the crew had removed their environment suits and armor, Holden said,
"Alex, this is Prax Mung. Prax, this is the solar system's best pilot, Alex Kamal."
Prax shook Alex's hand.
"Thank you for helping me find May."
Alex frowned a question at Holden, but a quick shake of the head kept him from asking it.
"Nice to meet you, Prax." "Alex," Holden said, "get us warmed up for liftoff, but don't take off until I'm up in the co-pilot's chair."
"Roger,"
Alex said, and headed toward the bow of the ship. "Everything's sideways," Prax said, looking around at the storage room just past the inner airlock door.
"The Rosie doesn't spend much time on her belly like this," Naomi said, taking his hand and leading him to the crew ladder, which now appeared to run across the floor.
"We're standing on a bulkhead, and that wall to our right is normally the deck."
"Grew up in low grav and don't spend much time on ships, apparently," Amos said. "Man, this next part is really gonna suck for you."
"Naomi," Holden said, "get to ops and get belted in. Amos, take Prax to the crew deck and then head down to engineering and get the Rosie ready for a rough ride."
Before they could leave, Holden put a hand on Prax's shoulder.
"This takeoff and flight is going to be fast and bumpy. If you haven't trained for a high G flight, it will probably be very uncomfortable."
"Don't worry about me," Prax said, making what he probably thought was a brave face.
"I know you're tough. You couldn't have survived the last couple weeks otherwise. You don't have anything to prove at this point. Amos will take you to the crew deck. Find a room without a name on the door. That will be your room now. Get in the crash couch and buckle in. Then hit the bright green button on the panel to your left. The couch will pump you full of drugs that will sedate you and keep you from blowing a blood vessel if we have to burn hard."
"My room?" Prax said, an odd note in his voice.
"We'll get you some clothes and sundries once we're out of this shit. You can keep them there."
"My room," Prax repeated.
"Yeah," Holden said.
"Your room." He could see Prax fighting down a lump in his throat, and he realized what the simple offer of comfort and safety probably meant to someone who'd been through what the small botanist had over the last month. There were tears in the man's eyes.
"Come on, let's get you settled in," Amos said, leading Prax aft toward the crew deck.
Holden headed the other way, past the ops deck where Naomi was already strapped down into a chair at one of the workstations, then forward into the cockpit. He climbed into the co-pilot's seat and belted in.
5 minutes, he said over the ship-wide channel.
So, Alex said, dragging the word out to two syllables while he flicked switches to finish the pre-flight check. We're looking for someone named May?
Prax's daughter.
We do that now? Seems like the scope of our mission is creeping a bit.
Holden nodded. Finding lost daughters was not part of their mandate. That had been Miller's job. And he'd never be able to adequately explain the certainty he felt that this lost little girl was at the center of everything that had happened on Ganymede.
I think this lost little girl is at the center of everything that's happened on Ganymede, he said with a shrug.
Okay, Alex replied, then hit something on a panel twice and frowned. Huh, we have a red on the board. Getting a no seal on the cargo airlock. Might have caught some flak on the way down, I guess. It was pretty hot up there.
Well, we're not going to stop and fix it now, Holden said. We keep the bay in vacuum most of the time anyway. If the inner hatch into the cargo area is showing a good seal, just override the alarm and let's go.
Roger, Alex said, and tapped the override.
1 minute. Holden said over the ship-wide, then turned to Alex. So, I'm curious.
Bout?
How'd you manage to slip through that shitstorm up above us? And can you do it again on the way out?
Alex laughed.
It's a simple matter of never being higher than the second highest threat on anyone's board. And, of course, not being there anymore when they decide to get around to you.
I'm giving you a raise. Holden said. Then began the 10-second countdown. At one, the Rossi blasted off of Ganymede on four pillars of superheated steam.
Rotate us for a full burn as soon as you can, Holden said, the rumble of the ship's takeoff giving him an artificial vibrato.
This close?
There's nothing below us that matters, Holden said. Thinking of the remnants of black filament they'd seen in the hidden base.
Melted.
Okay, Alex said. Then, once the ship had finished orienting straight up, he said, Giving her the spurs.
Even with the juice coursing through his blood, Holden blacked out for a moment. When he came to, the Rossi was veering wildly from side to side. The cockpit was alive with the sounds of warning buzzers.
Whoa, honey, Alex was saying under his breath. Whoa, big girl.
Naomi, Holden said, looking at a confusing mass of red on the threat board and trying to decipher it with his blood-starved brain. Who's firing at us?
Everyone.
She sounded as groggy as he felt.
Yeah, Alex said, his tension draining some of the good old boy drawl out of his voice. She's not kidding.
The swarm of threats on his display began to make sense, and Holden saw they were right. It looked like half of the inner planet ships on their side of Ganymede had lobbed at least one missile at them. He entered the command code to set all the weapons to free fire and sent control of the aft PDCs to Amos.
Amos, cover our asses.
Alex was doing his best to keep any of the incoming missiles from catching them, but ultimately, that was a lost cause. Nothing with meat inside it could outrun metal and silicone.
Where are we?
Holden said, stopping to target a missile that wandered into the front starboard PDC's firing arc. The point defense cannon fired off a long burst at it. The missile was smart enough to turn sharply and evade, but its sudden course change bought them a few more seconds.
Callisto's on our side of Jupiter, Alex said, referring to the next sizable moon out from Ganymede. Gonna get in its shadow.
Holden checked the vectors of the ships that had fired at them. If any of them were pursuing, Alex's gambit would only buy them a few minutes. But it didn't appear they were. Of the dozen or so that had attacked them, over half were moderately to severely damaged, and the ones that weren't were still busy shooting at each other.
Seems like we were everyone's number one threat there for a second, Holden said. But not so much anymore.
Yeah, sorry about that, Cap. Not sure why that happened.
Well, I don't blame you, Holden said. The Rossi shuddered, and Amos gave a whoop over the shipwide comm.
Don't be trying to touch my girl's ass.
Two of the closer missiles had vanished off the threat board.
Nice work, Amos, Holden said, checking the updated times to impact and seeing that they'd bought another half minute.
Shit, Cap, the Rossi does all the work, Amos said. I just encourage her to express herself.
Going to duck and cover around Callisto. I'd appreciate a distraction,
Alex said to Holden.
Okay, Naomi, another 10 seconds or so, Holden said. Then hit them with everything you've got. We'll need them blind for a few seconds.
Roger, Naomi said.
Holden could see her prepping a massive assault package of laser clutter and radio jamming. The Rocinante lurched again, and the moon Callisto suddenly filled Holden's forward screen. Alex hurtled toward it at a suicidal rate, flipping the ship and hard burning at the last second to throw them into a long, slingshot orbit.
3, 2, 1, now, he said.
The Rossi diving tail first toward Callisto, whipping past it so low that Holden felt like he could have reached out the airlock and scooped up some snow. At the same time, Naomi's jamming package hammered the sensors of the pursuing missiles, blinding them while their processors worked to cut through the noise. By the time they'd reacquired the Rocinante, she'd been thrown around Callisto by gravity and her own drive in a new vector and at high speed. Two of the missiles gamely tried to come about and pursue, but the rest either limped off in random directions or slammed into the moon. When their two pursuers had gotten back on course, the Rossi had opened up an enormous lead and could take her time shooting them down.
We made it, Alex said.
Holden found the disbelief in his pilot's voice fairly disconcerting. Had it been that close?
Never doubted it, Holden said. Take us to Tycho. Half a G. I'll be in my cabin.
When they were finished, Naomi flopped onto her side in their shared bunk, sweat plastering her curly black hair to her forehead. She was still panting. He was too.
That was vigorous, she said.
Holden nodded, but didn't have enough air to actually speak yet. When he climbed down the ladder from the cockpit, Naomi had been waiting, already out of her restraints. She grabbed him and kissed him so hard his lip had split. He hadn't even noticed. They'd barely reached the cabin with their clothes on. What had happened afterward was a sort of blur now to Holden, though his legs were tired and his lip hurt. Naomi rolled across him and climbed out of the bunk.
I've got to pee, she said, pulling on a robe and heading out the door.
Holden just nodded to her, still not quite capable of speech. He shifted over to the middle of the bed, stretching out his arms and legs for a moment. The truth was, the Rossi's cabins were not built for two occupants, least of all the crash couches that doubled as beds. But over the course of the last year, he'd spent more and more time sleeping in Naomi's cabin, until it sort of became their cabin, and he just didn't sleep anywhere else anymore. They couldn't share the bunk during high G maneuvers, but so far they'd never been asleep any time the ship had needed to do high G maneuvering, a trend that was likely to continue. Holden was starting to doze off when the hatch opened and Naomi came back in. She tossed a cold, wet washcloth onto his belly.
Wow, that's bracing, Holden said, sitting up with a start.
It was hot when I left the head with it.
That, Holden said while he cleaned up, sounded very dirty.
Naomi grinned, then sat on the edge of the bed and poked him in the ribs.
You can still think of sex? I would have thought we got that out of your system. A close brush with death does wonderful things for my refractory period. Naomi climbed into the bunk next to him, still wrapped in her robe. You know, she said, this was my idea. I'm all in favor of reaffirming life through sex. Why do I get the feeling that there's a but missing at the end of that sentence? But, there it is. There's something we need to talk about, and this seems a good time. Holden rolled over onto his side, facing her, and pushed up onto one elbow. A thick strand of hair was hanging in her face, and he brushed it back with his other hand. What did I do? He said. It's not exactly anything you've done, Naomi said. It's more what we're heading off to do right now. Holden put his hand on her arm, but waited for her to continue. The soft cloth of her robe clung to the wet skin beneath it. I'm worried, she said, that we're flying off to Tycho to do something really rash. Naomi, you weren't there. You didn't see. I saw it, Jim, through Amos's suit cam. I know what it is. I know how much it scares you. It scares the hell out of me, too. No, Holden said, his voice surprising him with its anger. No, you don't. You weren't on Eros when it got out. You never, hey, I was there. Maybe not for the worst of it. Not like you, Naomi said, her voice still calm. But I did help carry what was left of you and Miller to the medbay, and I watched you try to die there. We can't just accuse Fred of right now, and I mean right now, Ganymede could be changing. No, yes. Yes, it could. We could be leaving a couple million dead people behind right now who don't know it yet. Melissa and Santachai, remember them? Now, think of them stripped down to whatever pieces the protomolecule finds most useful at the moment. Think of them as parts. Because if that bug is loose on Ganymede, then that's what they are. Jim, Naomi said, a warning in her low voice, this is what I'm talking about. The intensity of your feelings isn't evidence. You're about to accuse a man who's been your friend and patron for the last year of maybe killing an entire moon full of people. That isn't the Fred we know. And you owe him better than that. Holden pushed up to a sitting position, part of him wanting to physically distance himself from Naomi, the part of him that was angry with her for not sympathizing enough. I gave Fred the last of it. I gave it to him. And he swore right to my face he'd never use it. But that's not what I saw down there. You call him my friend, but Fred has only ever done what would advance his own cause. Even helping us was just another move in his political game. Experiments on kidnapped children? Naomi said. A whole moon, one of the most important in the outer planets, put at risk and maybe killed outright? Does that make any sense to you? Does that sound like Fred Johnson? The OPA wants Ganymede even more than either inner planet does, Holden said, finally admitting the thing he'd feared since they'd found the black filament. And they wouldn't give it to him. Stop, Naomi said. Maybe he's trying to drive them off, or he sold it to them in exchange for the moon. That would at least explain the heavy inner planets traffic we've been seeing. No, stop, she said. I don't want to sit here and listen to you talk yourself into this. Holden started to speak, but Naomi sat up facing him and gently put her hand over his mouth. I didn't like this new Jim Holden you've been turning into. The guy who'd rather reach for his gun than talk. I know being the OPA's bag man has been a shitty job, and I know we've had to do a lot of pretty rotten things in the name of protecting the belt. But that was still you. I could still see you lurking there under the surface, waiting to come back. Naomi, he said, pulling her hand away from his face. This guy who can't wait to go all high noon in the streets of Tycho, that's not Jim Holden at all. I don't recognize that man, she said, then frowned. No, that's not right. I do recognize him. But his name was Miller. For Holden, the most awful part was how calm she was. She never raised her voice, never sounded angry. Instead, infinitely worse, there was only a resigned sadness. If that's who you are now, you need to drop me off somewhere. I can't go with you anymore, she said. I'm out. Chapter 23 Avasarala. Avasarala stood at her window, looking out at the morning haze. In the distance, a transport lifted off. It rode an exhaust plume that looked like a pillar of bright, white cloud, and then it was gone. Her hands ached. She knew that some of the photons striking her eyes right now had come from explosions light minutes away. Ganymede Station, once the safest place without an atmosphere, then a war zone, and now a wasteland. She could no more pick out the light of its death than pluck a particular molecule of salt from the ocean. But she knew it was there, and the fact was like a stone in her belly. I can ask for a confirmation, Sorin said. Nguyen should be filing his command report in the next 18 hours. Once we have that, we'll know what he said, Avasarala snapped. I can tell you that right now. The Martian forces took a threatening position, and he was forced to respond aggressively. La la fucking la. Where did he get the ships? He's an admiral, Sorin said. I thought he came with them. She turned. The boy looked tired. He'd been up since the small hours of the morning, they all had. His eyes were bloodshot and his skin pallid and clammy. I took apart that command group myself, she said. I pared it down until you could have drowned it in a bathtub. And he's out there now with enough firepower to take on the Martian fleet? Apparently, Sorin said. She fought the urge to spit. The rumble of the transport engines finally reached her, the sound muffled by distance and the glazing. The light was already gone. To her sleep-deprived mind, it was exactly like playing politics in the Jovian system or the Belt. Something happened, she could see it happen, but she heard it only after the fact, when it was too late. She'd made a mistake. Nguyen was a warhawk. The kind of adolescent boy who still thought any problem could be solved by shooting it enough. Everything he'd done was as subtle as a lead pipe to the kneecap, until this. Now, he'd reassembled his command without her knowing it, and he'd had her pulled from the Martian negotiations. Which meant that he hadn't done any of it. Nguyen had either a patron or a cabal. She hadn't seen that he was a bit player, so whoever called his tune had surprised her. She was playing against shadows, and she hated it. More light, she said. Excuse me? Find out how he got those ships, she said. Do it before you go to sleep. I want a full accounting. Where the replacement ships came from, who ordered them, how they were justified. Everything. Would you also like a pony, ma'am? You're fucking right I would, she said, and sagged against her desk. You do good work. Someday you might get a real job. I'm looking forward to it, ma'am. Is she still around? At her desk, Sorin said. Should I send her in? You better had. When Bobby came into the room, a film of cheap paper in her fist, it struck Avasarala again how poorly the Martian fit in. It wasn't only her accent or the difference in build that spoke of a childhood in the lower Martian gravity. In the halls of politics, the woman's air of physical competence stood out.
She looked like she'd been rousted out of bed in the middle of the night, just like all of them. It was only that it looked good on her. Might be useful, might not. But certainly it was worth remembering.
What have you got?
Avasarala asked. The Marine's frown was all in her forehead. I've gotten through to a couple of people in the command. Most of them don't know who the hell I am, though. I probably spent as much time telling them I was working for you as I did talking about Ganymede.
It's a lesson. Martian bureaucrats are stupid, venal people. What did they say?
Long story?
Short.
You shot at us. Avasarala leaned back in her chair. Her back hurt, her knees hurt, and the knot of sorrow and outrage that was always just under her heart felt brighter than usual.
Of course we did, she said. The peace delegation?
Already gone, Bobby said. They'll be releasing a statement sometime tomorrow about how the UN was negotiating in bad faith. They're still fighting out the exact wording.
What's the hold?
Bobby shook her head. She didn't understand.
What words are they fighting over? And which side wants which words?
Avasarala demanded.
I don't know. Does it matter?
Of course it mattered. The difference between the UN has been negotiating in bad faith and the UN was negotiating in bad faith could be measured in hundreds of lives. Thousands. Avasarala tried to swallow her impatience. It didn't come naturally.
All right, she said. See if there's anything else you can get me.
Bobby held out the paper. Avasarala took it.
The hell is this?
She asked. My resignation, Bobby said. I thought you'd want all the paperwork in place. We're at war now, so I'll be shipping back. Getting my new assignment.
Who recalled you?
No one yet, Bobby said, but
will you please sit down? I feel like I'm at the bottom of a fucking well talking to you.
The Marine sat. Avasarala took a deep breath.
Do you want to kill me?
Avasarala asked. Bobby blinked, and before she could answer, Avasarala lifted her hand, commanding silence.
I am one of the most powerful people in the UN. We're at war. So, do you want to kill me?
I guess so.
You don't. You want to find out who killed your men, and you want the politicians to stop greasing the wheels with marine blood. And holy shit, what do you know? I want that too.
But I'm active duty Martian military, Bobby said. If I stay working for you, I'm committing treason. The way she said it wasn't complaint or accusation.
They haven't recalled you, Avasarala said, and they're not going to. The wartime diplomatic code of contact is almost exactly the same for you as it is for us, and it's 10,000 pages of 9-point type. If you get orders right now, I can put up enough queries and requests for clarifications that you'll die of old age in that chair. If you just want to kill someone for Mars, you're not going to get a better target than me. If you want to stop this idiotic fucking war and find out who's actually behind it, get back to your desk and find out who wants that wording.
Bobby was silent for a long moment.
You mean that as a rhetorical device, she said at last. But it would make a certain amount of sense to kill you. And I can do it.
A tiny chill hit Avasarala's spine, but she didn't let it reach her face.
I'll try not to oversell the point in the future. Now, get back to work.
Yes, sir, Bobby said, then stood and walked out of the room.
Avasarala blew out a breath, her cheeks ballooning.
She was inviting Martian Marines to slaughter her in her own office. She needed a fucking nap. Her hand terminal chimed. An unscheduled high status report had just come through.
the deep red banner overriding her usual display settings. She tapped it, ready for more bad news from Ganymede. It was about Venus. Until 7 hours earlier, the Arbogast had been a third-generation destroyer, built at the Bush shipyards 13 years before, and later refitted as a military science vessel. For the last 8 months, she'd been orbiting Venus. Most of the active scanning data that Avasarala had relied on had come from her. The event she was watching had been captured by 2 lunar telescopic stations with broad-spectrum intelligence feeds that happened to be at the correct angles, and about 12 shipborne optical observers. The dataset they collected agreed perfectly. "Play it again," Avasarala said. Michael John de Uterbe had been a field technician when she'd first met him 30 years before. Now he was the de facto head of the Special Sciences Committee and married to Avasarala's roommate from university. In that time, his hair had fallen out or grown white. His dark brown skin had taken to draping a bit off of his bones, and he hadn't changed the brand of cheap floral cologne he wore. He had always been an intensely shy, almost antisocial man. In order to maintain the connection, she knew not to ask too much of him. His small, cluttered office was less than 1/4 mile from hers, and she had seen him 5 times in the last decade, each of them moments when she needed to understand something obscure and complex quickly. He tapped his hand terminal twice, and the images on the display reset. The Arbogast was whole once more, floating in false color detail above the haze of Venusian cloud. The timestamp started moving forward, 1 second per second. "Walk me through," she said.
Well, we start from the spike. It's just like the one we saw that last time Ganymede started going to hell."
"Splendid. That's 2 data points."
"This came before the fighting," he said. "Maybe an hour, a little less."
It had come during Holden's firefight, before she could bring him in. But how could Venus be responding to Holden's raid on Ganymede? Had Bobby's monsters been part of that fight?
"Then the radio ping, right," he froze the display, "here. Massive sweep in 3 second by 7 second grid. It was looking, but it knew where to look. All those active scans, I'd assume, called attention."
"All right."
He started the playback again. The resolution went a few degrees grainier, and he made a pleased sound.
"This was interesting," he said, as if the rest were not. "Radiative pulse of some kind. Interfered with all the telescopy except for a strictly visible spectrum kit on Luna. Only lasted 1/10 of a second, though. The microwave burst after it was pretty normal active sensor scanning."
"You sound disappointed," perched at the back of Avasarala's tongue, but the dread and anticipation of what would come next stopped it.
The Arbogast, with 572 souls aboard her, came apart like a cloud. Hull plates peeled away in neat, orderly rows. Superstructural girders and decks shifted apart. The engineering bays detached, slipping away. In the image before her, the full crew had been exposed to hard vacuum. In the moment she was looking at now, they were all dying and not yet dead. That it was like watching a construction plan animation, crew quarters here, the engineering section here, the plates cupping the drive thus and so, only made it more monstrous.
"Now, this is especially interesting," Michael John said, stopping the playback. "Watch what happens when we increase magnification."
"Don't show them to me," Avasarala wanted to say. "I don't want to watch them die."
But the image he moved in on wasn't a human being, but a knot of complicated ducting.
He advanced it slowly, frame by frame, and the image grew misty.
It's ablating? She asked.
What? No, no, here, I'll bring you closer.
The image jumped in again. The cloudiness was an illusion created by a host of small bits of metal, bolts, nuts, Edison clamps, O-rings. She squinted. It wasn't a loose cloud, either. Like iron filings under the influence of a magnet, each tiny piece was held in line with the ones before and behind it.
The Arbogast wasn't torn apart, he said. It was disassembled.
It looks as though there were about 15 separate waves, each one undoing another level of the mechanism.
Strip the whole thing down to the screws.
Avasarala took a deep breath, then another, until the sound lost its ragged edge and the awe and fear grew small enough that she could push it to the back of her mind.
What does this?
She said at last. She'd meant it as a rhetorical question. Of course, there was no answer. No force known to humanity could do what had just been done. That wasn't the meaning he took.
Graduate students, he said brightly. My industrial design final was just the same. They gave us all machines, and we had to take them apart and figure out what they did. Extra credit was to deliver an improved design.
And a moment later, his voice melancholy, of course, we also had to put them back together, yes?
On the display, the rigidity and order of the floating bits of metal stopped, and the bolts and girders, vast ceramic plates and minute clamps began to drift, set in chaotic motion by the departure of whatever had been holding them. 70 seconds, from first burst to the end. A little over a minute, and not a shot fired in response. Not even something clearly to be shot.
The crew took their suits apart. Didn't bother disassembling the bodies. Might have interpreted them as a logical unit, or might already know all it needs to about human anatomy.
Who's seen this?
Michael John blinked, then shrugged, then blinked again.
This, or a version of this?
We're the only one with both high def feeds, but it's Venus. Everyone who was looking saw it. Not like it's in a sealed lab.
She closed her eyes, pressing her fingers against the bridge of her nose as if she were fighting a headache while she struggled to keep the mask in place. Better to seem in pain. Better to seem impatient. The fear shook her like a seizure, like something happening to somebody else. Tears welled up in her eyes, and she bit her lip until they went away. She pulled up the personnel locator on her hand terminal. Nguyen was out of the question, even if he'd been in conversational range. Nettleford was with a dozen ships burning toward Ceres Station, and she wasn't entirely certain of him.
Souther.
Can you send this version to Admiral Souther?
Oh, no. It's not cleared for release.
Avasarala looked at him, her expression empty.
Are you clearing it for release?
I am clearing it for release to Admiral Souther. Please send it immediately.
Michael John bobbed a quick nod, tapping with the tips of both pinkies.
Avasarala took out her own hand terminal and sent a simple message to Souther. Watch and call me. When she stood, her legs ached.
It was good seeing you again, Michael John said, not looking at her. We should all have dinner sometime.
Let's, Avasarala said, and left. The women's restroom was cold. Avasarala stood at the sink, her palms flat against the granite. She wasn't used to fear or awe. Her life had been about control. Talking and bullying and teasing whoever needed it until the world turned the direction she wanted it to. The few times the implacable universe had overwhelmed her, haunted her. An earthquake in Bengal when she'd been a girl, a storm in Egypt that had trapped her and Arjun in their hotel room for 4 days as the food supplies failed, the death of her son. Each one had turned her constant pretense of certainty and pride against her, left her curled in her bed at night for weeks afterward, her fingers bent in claws, her dreams nightmares. This was worse. Before, she could comfort herself with the idea that the universe was empty of intent, that all the terrible things were just the accidental convergences of chance and mindless forces. The death of the Arbogast was something else. It was intentional and inhuman. It was like seeing the face of God and finding no compassion there. Shaking, she pulled up her hand terminal. Arjun answered almost immediately. From the set of his jaw and the softness of his eyes, she knew he had seen some version of the event. And his thought hadn't been for the fate of mankind, but for her. She tried to smile, but it was too much. Tears ran down her cheeks. Arjun sighed gently and looked down. "I love you very much," Avasarala said. "Knowing you has let me bear the unbearable." Arjun grinned. He looked good with wrinkles. He was a more handsome man now that he was older. As if the round-faced, comically earnest boy who'd snuck to her window to read poems in the night had only been waiting to become this. "I love you. I have always loved you. If we are born into new lives, I will love you there." Avasarala sobbed once, wiped her eyes with the back of her hand, and nodded. "All right, then," she said. "Back to work?" "Back to work. I may be home late. I'll be here. You can wake me." They were silent for a moment. Then she released the connection. Admiral Souther hadn't called. Ehrenreich hadn't called. Avasarala's mind was leaping around like a terrier attacking a troop transport. She rose to her feet, forced herself to put one foot in front of the other. The simple physical act of walking seemed to clear her head. Little electric carts stood ready to whisk her back to her office, but she ignored them, and by the time she reached it, she was almost calm again. Bobby sat hunched at her desk, the sheer physical bulk of the woman making the furniture seem like something from grade school. Sorin was elsewhere, which was fine. His training wasn't military. "So, you're in an entrenched position with a huge threat coming down onto you, right?" Avasarala said, sitting down on the edge of Sorin's desk. "Say you're on a moon, and some third party has thrown a comet at you. Massive threat. You understand?" Bobby looked at her, confused for a moment, and then with a shrug played along. "All right," the Marine said. "So, why do you choose that moment to pick a fight with your neighbors? Are you just frightened and lashing out? Are you thinking that the other bastards are responsible for the rock? Are you just that stupid?" "We're talking about Venus and the fighting in the Jovian system," Bobby said. "It's a pretty fucking thin metaphor, yes," Avasarala said. "So, why are you doing it?" Bobby leaned back in her chair, plastic creaking under her. The big woman's eyes narrowed. She opened her mouth once, closed it, frowned, and began again. "I'm consolidating power," Bobby said. "If I use my resources stopping the comet,
Then, as soon as that threat's gone, I lose. The other guy catches me with my pants down. Bang. If I kick his ass first, then, when it's over, I win. But if you cooperate, then you have to trust the other guy, Bobby said, shaking her head. There's a million tons of ice coming that's going to kill you both. Why the hell wouldn't you trust the other guy?
Depends. Is he an Earther? Bobby said.
We've got two major military forces in the system, plus whatever the Belters can gin up. That's three sides with a lot of history. When whatever's going to happen on Venus actually happens, someone wants to already have all the cards. And if both sides, Earth and Mars, are making that same calculation, we're going to spend all our energy getting ready for the war after next.
Yep, Bobby said. And yes, that's how we all lose together.
Chapter 24. Prax. Prax sat in his cabin. For sleeping space on a ship, he knew it was large. Spacious, even. Altogether, it was smaller than his bedroom on Ganymede had been. He sat on the gel-filled mattress, the acceleration gravity pressing him down, making his arms and legs feel heavier than they were. He wondered whether the sense of suddenly weighing more, specifically the discontinuous change of space travel, triggered some evolutionary cue for fatigue. The feeling of being pulled to the floor or the bed was so powerfully like the sensation of bone-melting tiredness, it was easy to think that sleeping a little more would fix it, would make things better. "Your daughter is probably dead," he said aloud. Waited to see how his body would react. "May is probably dead." He didn't start sobbing this time, so that was progress. Ganymede was a day and a half behind him, and already too small to pick out with the naked eye. Jupiter was a dim disk the size of a pinky nail, kicking back the light of a sun that was little more than an extremely bright star. Intellectually, he knew that he was falling sunward, heading in from the Jovian system toward the belt. In a week, the sun would be close to twice the size it was now, and it would still be insignificant. In a context of such immensity, of distances and speed so far above any meaningful human experience, it seemed like nothing should matter. He should be agreeing that he hadn't been there when God made the mountains, whether it meant the ones on Earth or on Ganymede or somewhere farther out in the darkness. He was in a tiny metal and ceramic box that was exchanging matter for energy to throw a half dozen primates across a vacuum larger than millions of oceans. Compared to that, how could anything matter? "Your daughter is probably dead," he said again. And this time the words caught in his throat and started to choke him. It was, he thought, something about the sense of being suddenly safe. On Ganymede, he'd had fear to numb him. Fear and malnutrition and routine and the ability at any moment to move, to do something, even if it was utterly useless. Go check the boards again. Go wait in line at security, trot along the hallways and see how many new bullet holes pocked them. On the Rocinante, he had to slow down. He had to stop. There was nothing for him to do here but wait out the long sunward fall to Tycho Station. He couldn't distract himself. There was no station, not even a wounded and dying one, to hunt through. There were only the cabin he'd been given, his hand terminal, a few jumpsuits a half size too big for him, a small box of generic toiletries. That was everything he had left. And there was enough food and clean water that his brain could start working again. Each passing hour felt like waking up a little more. He knew how badly his body and mind had been abused only when he got better. Every time, he felt like this had to be back to normal. And then, not long after, he'd find that, no, there had been more. So he explored himself, probing at the wound at the center of his personal world like pressing the tip of his tongue into a dry socket. "Your daughter," he said through the tears, "is probably dead. But if she isn't, you have to find her." That felt better. Or, if not better, at least right. He leaned forward, his hands clasped, and rested his chin. Carefully, he imagined Katoa's body laid out on its table. When his mind rebelled, trying to think about something, anything else, he brought it back and put May in the boy's place. Quiet, empty, dead. The grief welled up from a place just above his stomach, and he watched it like it was something outside himself. During his time as a graduate student, he had done data collection for a study of Pinus contorta. Of all the varieties of pine to rise off Earth, lodgepole pine had been the most robust in low-G environments. His job had been to collect the fallen cones and burn them for the seeds. In the wild, lodgepole pine wouldn't germinate without fire. The resin in the cones encouraged a hotter fire, even when it meant the death of the parental tree. To get better, it had to get worse. To survive, the plant had to embrace the unsurvivable. He understood that.